fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today our travels on Route 51 take us halfway around the world to a place where human history is measured not in hundreds of years, but in many, many thousands of years. Lebanon has played an important part in the history of the world since ancient times, with a location midway between the eastern and western worlds, a nation of ports and commerce and trade from the time of the Pharaohs and Phoenicians to the modern Middle East, where nearby Israel has become a flashpoint in a struggle between nations, cultures, and religions. In this often volatile world, Lebanon is perhaps the best hope for the future, usually an oasis of relative calm, where a 2,000-year-old Christian population coexists peacefully with a Muslim majority, and where disputes are settled more often by compromise than by violence. We welcome back from Lebanon today two Wausau East Exchange students, Mary Baldwin and Michael Ryer, and their guide, UW Marathon County Associate Professor of History, Jeff Lee. We'll be getting their firsthand impressions of the people of Lebanon, their customs, their culture, and their politics. And as always, we'd like you to join the conversation. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 261-6371. That's 261-6371, or toll free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. Michael, Mary, and Jeff, welcome to Route 51, and welcome back.
Thank you, Glenn. Thank you.
Jeff, why don't we start off with you, since you are the professor of history. Tell us a little bit about the history of Lebanon. And I know that if I gave you the checkered flag here, you could go for the next hour. But give us a Cliff Notes version of why this area has been so significant for so long.
All right, Glenn, I'll try to do that. Make sure you wave me off if it's going too long. The first thing to understand about Lebanon is the geography. The modern state of Lebanon is only about 4,000 square miles, as contrasted with Wisconsin, which is about 56,000 square miles. It's a fairly small area. Human habitation there goes back in excess of 10,000 years. Back before you had any settled human populations, before you had agriculture, you had people living in the area that has become Lebanon. By the time you get up to the Phoenicians, about 3000 BCE, this has become a major center of agriculture. They're still quite small societies, but mm-hmm. the societies that can sustain themselves. Under the Phoenicians, it becomes a major center of trade, connecting the eastern part of the Fertile Crescent, today's Iraq, and lands further east with Egypt to the south, a little bit later in history, Israel to the south, the Greeks a little bit later on still, and ultimately the entire Mediterranean basin.
And the whole time, this area of Lebanon was an important trade route.
Sure. You had the ancient cities of Sidon and Tyre and Byblos and Beirut now and Tripoli, all located right there along the coastline with their backs to the mountains.
How close are the mountains?
The mountains are anywhere from right down to the sea to maybe about 5 miles back. It's a very small coastal plain. Today, the cities, of course, are going up the first slope of the mountains.
Most of the population, is it on that coastal
plain? The overwhelming majority. It's about 4 million people there, 1.5 million estimated in Beirut itself. I would assume that well over three-quarters of the population is within 2 miles of the sea.
Well, this is a volatile part of the world, a lot of different cultures, different religions, all struggling with each other for prominence and for physical space. And as he said, not much of that in Lebanon.
No, it's a very interesting area. Again, these were sea-going civilizations going back at least 5,000 years ago, and they're connecting all parts of that ancient world there. Lebanon itself is ruled over by, after the Phoenicians, you have Assyrians, you have Hittites, you have the Egyptian Empire, you've got the Greeks, you've got the Romans, you've got the Persians, you've got the Ottomans, and then after World War I, the French Mandate. So it does have a long history of foreign rule, a long history of lots of different people entering the region, settling down, and their cultures mixing.
Is it predominantly Muslim?
Today, it's assumed to be about 60% Muslim. There hasn't been a census since 1932.
But there's a big Christian population.
There's a large Christian population. The 1932 census recorded about 60% Christian population. Now, it's not just one Christian sect. It's a multitude of Christian sects. Recorded about 60%. 60%. There's some question as to whether those numbers were accurate or not. The Taif Accords of 1990 rejiggered politics to give the Christians about 50% of the seats in parliament, the Muslims another 50%. Right now, estimates say that Muslims are probably actually about 60%, though, of course, that is contested.
Any kind of a Jewish population? You do have Israel immediately to the south, which might affect...
That certainly did affect it. You had very large Jewish populations, particularly before the advent of Islam. The region was overwhelmingly Christian before the advent of Islam in the 7th and 8th centuries. And then you, of course, have this slow conversion over to Islam itself. There was a Jewish population all along, but, of course, the foundation of the State of Israel caused two things. One, a migration to the State of Israel, and second, of course, with the hostilities between Israel and all of its neighbors, it became very difficult to Israel for Jews to live anywhere in surrounding countries, so that caused a second migration.
Now, by and large, Lebanon's a pretty peaceful place, isn't it?
Well, on and off.
I mean, given the dynamic that's going on there.
Given the dynamic, I would say, yeah, it is remarkable how well they have done coexisting, and that's not necessarily due to the nature of the various religions, but due to the fact that it's very difficult for people to deal with this much continual change and this much variety in population. The United States, of course, has a tremendous experience in that as well.
2 years ago, though, southern Lebanon was being bombed every day by Israel, and that memory, that's got to be prominent in the minds of a lot of Lebanese people.
It is extremely important. Summer of 2006, the Israelis bombed and then led a land offensive into Lebanon lasting 34 days. They killed over 1,100 people there. That was a flare-up in the Hezbollah Israeli confrontation that had been going on since the early 1980s. And, of course, it does cause a tremendous amount of damage, not only in the south where Hezbollah has a significant power base, but the Israelis bombed throughout the country.
Given that history, how difficult was it for you and for the people who organized this exchange trip to get approval?
Well, we didn't have any troubles from the U.S. government. This was an embassy-arranged trip. Our cultural attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Lebanon, Richard Michaels, established the whole thing with embassy approval. He found a school in Lebanon that wanted to work with us, wanted to have American kids, and wanted to send their kids to the American school. And we took it to the Wausau School District. They said, well, you know, proceed with caution. In the end, though, due to primarily insurance issues, they backed out of the trip. The embassy said, well, fine, we'll run it anyways. And the school district did assist us so far, saying, okay, we will not stand in the way of you doing this as a non-school trip.
Michael, how did you feel when you heard that the school district had backed out of this trip and you were going to Lebanon anyway?
Well, I felt maybe a little bit victorious because the first news and I heard that the school was no longer sponsoring the trip, I thought, well, I didn't think I was going to be able to go. And that was kind of heartbreaking for me because I was really looking forward to the trip. But when the news came that we would still be going, that they would still be like working towards this trip, my emotions just kind of ran wild because I was so excited.
Mary, what was your impression, your feeling as you got the word that this was a green light, you were going to go?
I reacted in a similar way. I was really excited about it, and I guess I was kind of pessimistic that it would happen at all after the school district had kind of shot it down. I was worried about, you know, with the conflict in Gaza and whatnot, but once we got the go-ahead, I was really excited.
When you got off the plane and you get into Lebanon, is that geography, is that the first thing that hits you, this, or maybe as you're heading into the airport, this slender piece of inhabited land with the mountains rising up behind and the Mediterranean in front?
Oh, it's astonishing. Like, we flew in over the Mediterranean, and the airport's actually right on the coast. So that's the first thing you see is the coast and the mountains. It's not really what anyone would expect going to the Middle East.
Right. It was definitely eye-opening right away, and I knew that I'd be learning so many things on this trip just by the first few sightings of the Mediterranean Sea and the mountains right next to it.
We're going to be talking to Michael Ryer, Mary Baldwin, about some of the things they did learn on that trip, along with their guide and our history professor, UW-Marathon County's Jeff Lee, when Route 51 continues. I'm Glenn Moberg. We do want to hear from you. Give us a call at 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
We're talking to Wausau East High School students Michael Ryer and Mary Baldwin and UW-Marathon County's Jeff Lee about the student exchange trip that they just took to Lebanon. And we do want to hear from you. Give us a call if you're interested in what these students had to see and what their impressions were of the Middle East, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Before we go forward, Jeff, I'm going to play a portion of interviews you did with the students when you were waiting in Detroit at the airport before you took off to Paris and then to Lebanon, of what the Wausau East students thought of when they thought of Lebanon in the Middle East. What were some of their impressions? This is what they thought about Lebanon before they left the United States.
I think a lot of people, it comes to mind that, like, it's not very civilized. You just think of deserts and sand and camels, and you don't realize that there are actually very cosmopolitan cities.
I also agree with that.
I just still don't know that much about it, and I'm really excited to find out what I don't know, but I don't know very much at all.
I think I'm just kind of excited to be in the foreign country and kind of see their perspective of Americans.
I think it'll be major culture shock when we arrive. I've been told that it's kind of bordering, like, between the Western and Eastern civilization, like mind frames.
I think images of conflict and war have been pretty prominent in my mind as we travel, and also with our parents, especially due to the postponement the last time that we weren't able to go due to conflict in Israel, and it's just so close.
What pops into my mind is turbans, primarily.
I guess,
driving,
like,
from Indiana Jones.
I guess, like, desert. I guess that's going to sound really dumb.
I think the first thing that comes into my head when I hear Middle East is sand. I don't really know why, but that's just it. And I think a lot of, like, maybe dangers, perhaps, too, because a lot of in the media is a lot of dangerous stuff, like nuclear weapons and, you know, so forth.
Also is the image of oil in the Middle East, which has been a big part of economic policy in Middle East.
I will agree with oil and sand. I think that one of the major images, actually, people in turbans.
I think when I hear Middle East, I think of war, torture, and a very harshness of life.
Harshness of life, war, torture, sand, oil, and turbans. That was your impressions before you left.
So you can see we didn't really know all that much.
How did things change?
Things changed a lot. I know the first time, right when I went to the airport, I'm away to leave the airport, actually. I probably, like, if I had not just gone off a plane after about 16 hours of flying, I would not have known that I was in Lebanon. It looked like we were still kind of in America because everything kind of looked the same, maybe different architecture. But other than that, it was pretty similar. But then all that kind of changed on driving back to my host family. I finally got a very big eye-opener that this is Lebanon, and this is what I'm going to be exposed to for a week. And the reason for that is the driving there is much different than what we're used to in America.
There aren't really any rules.
Yeah, there are no rules when you're driving. So the driver I had was pretty bad in American standards. He would be just curving left and right, passing cars, going on the sidewalk if he had to.
Oh, I bet he got you there in a hurry, though, didn't he?
He did. Yeah, we got there pretty quickly. But I was a little shaken up at the end of that, but I got used to it at the end. And that was probably just one thing, the start of what would become a very eye-opening experience.
But you see any turbans while you were there?
A few.
But the images, the predominant images of sand, oil, turbans, these caricatures, Mary, they turned out to be not so true.
Not at all. No, it was definitely like epitomized by like people's hospitality and how warm and like welcoming people were. And I mean, they were interested and curious about like, why are you here? Why did you want to come to Lebanon? What are you doing here? So it was a totally different experience than I think anyone really expected.
Jeff, as a teacher, you got to watch these students as their eyes were open to this new reality. How was that for you?
Oh, it was fascinating to see. This was my first trip to the Middle East. I've lived in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and Central Europe, traveled fairly extensively throughout Europe and the United States. But of course, this is my first trip after teaching Middle Eastern history for a decade, and so I was absorbing some of these interesting images as well. I knew, of course, from my own experience with my own students here, what these students would have on their minds, what they would be expecting out of it. And so, yeah, it was a joy to see their eyes opening and see just how things did not conform to their expectations.
You were in Beirut?
Beirut.
What was Beirut like? What does it look like from Western eyes?
Well, it's an enormous city, about 1.5 million people, much more densely packed than certainly any city in Wisconsin. Buildings rise to maybe on average 5-6 stories, so you don't have the skyscraper, so it's a fairly large area.
Is there a reason you don't have the skyscrapers? Is it earthquakes? Is it a volatile area in terms of?
You know, it may have more to do with the Civil War. There is still the unreconstructed Holiday Inn, which I'm guessing was about 20 stories tall. Yeah. And, of course, it's very expensive to put a building like that up, and it may be just that finance has been an issue since the Civil War. That, and related to the reason why finance is difficult, is maybe a little bit of insecurity in investing that much in a single structure.
Then you had, of course, the bombing from Israel a couple of years ago.
Right.
I guess it might make sense not to build those buildings too tall, too high up off the ground, because if they get hit by a bomb.
Yeah, there is a relatively, in this regard, conservative business culture in that you watch your investments and you don't do a lot of long-term planning. In fact, that fits right in with everything that's been said so far. You don't do a lot of long-range planning when you're trying to travel from here to there either, because you just don't know how long it's going to take to get across town.
But congested again because you've got just that narrow strip of land between the mountains and the sea.
Absolutely, and no substantial public transportation. So everyone is driving their own car or taking taxis.
That must have been a nightmare.
It was at times. I know the city of Beirut is very, and to my standards, a very kind of jumbled mess, I'd say. A lot of the streets, they're almost never straight. They're always, you know, curving.
It's kind of like built up the mountain. So like everything's like turning around a mountain or like really steep incline. So it's interesting just how it's built.
Yeah.
What were your host families like?
My host family, when I first got there, I wasn't able to meet with them because the parents were working. But the teenager, the student that I was staying with, was right away was welcoming, and pretty much anything he could do to help me, he did. So he showed me my room where I'd be staying. He showed me where all the food would be. Anything that a host would do in America, and then some.
Was poverty really evident to you when you were looking around, were the people you were staying with apparently were relatively affluent? They were well off enough to take in exchange students.
I mean, poverty is evident in some places. I mean, it's a very large city. It's just like, I guess, poverty that you would see anywhere. But I didn't actually stay with the host family. I stayed at the boarding house that's affiliated with Lesajes, the school that was hosting us. But as you, like, drive around Beirut, you see, like, people and, like, their children asking for money or, like, children selling things. I mean, there is poverty, and it's quite a contrast to what you would expect coming from rural Wisconsin.
And Jeff, what is the standard of living like there?
The individual income or per capita income is much lower than the United States. A lot of the people you saw are begging, I was told, were not Lebanese. They're people from further east who come to Lebanon because it's relatively affluent compared with most of the rest of the region. You do have unemployment. You've got concerns with foreign populations of Syrians and, of course, the Palestinians who have no working rights, maybe as many as 400,000 people in Lebanon in the camps with no working rights. And so there is a difficult labor situation. But again, you go back to what the Lebanese students are going to describe as the Lebanese way. You spend a lot of money on making sure that you enjoy what you can in life. And so you will see very expensive cars on the streets. You'll see people, the restaurants will be packed. You'll see very expensive stores seeming to do a fairly brisk business. As I was told, you have a lot of cosmetic surgery. Lots of people are figuring out ways to enjoy life while they're here and know that you can't always plan for the future.
400,000 Palestinians and Hezbollah is a factor. A couple of years ago, we had some exchange students on who grew up in the area. And one lady in particular had very positive things to say about Hezbollah, which has been branded as a terrorist organization. But she said, hey, they feed people. They take care of people. They're much, much more than that. And they're a legitimate political representatives of the Palestinian people. Did you, as students, encounter attitudes toward Hezbollah, and did they strike you as being something that you didn't hear about in the United States?
Well, I'm really interested in, like, politics in the region, so I ask questions of, like, the kids about Hezbollah, but it's interesting because they would never say it's one thing or another. They would always, like, find kind of a happy medium between, like, it's a terrorist organization or, like, it's helping our people, it's helping Palestinians, it's helping Lebanese. So it's interesting to see, like, where it falls in the society. And that just, like, reminds me of, we went to actually see the screening of a film made during the war in southern Lebanon in 2006. It was called Under the Bombs. And it was interesting to see, like, how many lives were affected by the war and, like, how that changed the perception of Hezbollah across the country, like, not just southern Lebanon. So.
Changed the perception in what way, Mary?
When
the bombs were falling, was there a reaction against Hezbollah or a reaction in support of it?
I'd say in support of it, because I think often Lebanese see it as the only protection they have, because the Lebanese military, from what I gather, is like made up of...
Got to hold that thought. We have to move on. I'm late for our break. You're listening to Route 51 on the Ideas Network.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Kimberly-Clark, home of Kleenex, Huggies, and Kotex brands, dedicated to social, economic, and environmental responsibility. Information about Kimberly-Clark is on the web at kimberly-clark.com.
I'm Glenn Mobrick. We're back on Route 51, Regional Talk Radio for North Central Wisconsin, talking to a couple of Wausau East High School students who are back from Lebanon on an exchange trip. We have with us Michael Ryer and Mary Baldwin, and the guide who accompanied them, UW Marathon County Associate Professor of History, Jeff Lee. It's been an interesting first half hour, and I'm sure the second half hour will go just as quickly. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have any questions or comments of your own, you can give us a call at 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. Mary, before I so rudely interrupted you before the news break, we were talking about Hezbollah and the fact that although it is widely regarded in Israel and in parts of the United States as a terrorist organization, it's not quite so cut and dried for a lot of people in Lebanon.
Right. I guess just like simply the Lebanese military is often perceived as a little less effective because like there are so many different groups represented within it. There are Sunnis and Shias and Christians and whatnot. And then they all kind of have their separate allegiances to those groups. But Hezbollah is like it is a Muslim group. So then it's kind of more cogent during times of crisis is often the perception.
And you were saying that when the bombing took place in Lebanon a couple of years ago, the reactions you got from some people is that maybe that made Hezbollah stronger and there was sort of a wave of support for it among the Lebanese population. Michael, did you talk to anybody about Hezbollah, the Palestinians, and the thing that was so prominent in the unrest there with Israel a couple of years ago?
Oh, to be honest, I really didn't mention it to many people. I wasn't sure if it was going to be a touchy subject or anything. However, I know that there were some like advertisements of the sort, like on banners along the streets and everything. So I knew that they weren't, that Hezbollah, the organization, was not seen as antagonistic as we see it here in America.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking as an American, it almost reminds me of the conflicting attitudes people had toward the Black Panther Party in some of the ghetto areas during the 60s. The supporters would say, hey, they've got these school breakfast programs and they're helping out in this way and that way. And the others would say, yeah, but they're also stockpiling automatic weapons in their apartments. You know, perhaps there's that kind of a dichotomy going on. But yet you have a Muslim population and a Christian population. For the most part, they get along.
Yeah, I thought that was very surprising. I know one of the trips we made, I think one of our first days, was down like in the downtown area where we saw a mosque and a church. And what surprised me is that they were right next to each other. The Muslim faith and the Christian faith.
Let's pick up on that. We have a recording, Jeff, that you made of the students when they were in Lebanon, and they were it was last day they were there, and they were about ready to leave. And you asked them about their impressions about the mosque in Beirut.
For me, probably the most interesting is how the late nights and the nightlife here, it's so different in comparison to the U.S. I mean, usually people eat dinner around, you know, 5 or 6, and here we go out to a restaurant around 9 or 10, and then you stay really late. And it's kind of enjoyable to see, you know, that everybody is like that, and just that everybody likes to have a good time together.
So. Another interesting experience that we had was attending a mosque in downtown Beirut. That was really cool. It made us realize what we don't have back in the States.
Yeah. And I think a really interesting thing, a part about that, is that it was like right next to a church. So whereas many people think that religion is such a, you know, strict thing here, and it is, but many people believe that due to a person's religion, that they're really like violent with other people who believe different things. But that's not the case here. Prime example would be this mosque.
So we went to this mosque, and we had a tour with the architect who built it, who spoke very English very well. We went in. The first thing we had to do is
all the girls cover their heads and wear the long black outfit.
Okay, long black robe
and a headscarf. I also thought it was really interesting how it's very lined up, how you had to line it up based on the east and west meridians. And I thought that was really cool how they really, you know, paid attention to that and everything. It was really interesting to learn that that the mosque had to be built a certain way.
Right. The Qibla is facing Mecca, and so you have long rows of people side by side by side. More importantly, then back to forward, because, of course, there's a very important egalitarian aspect to worship within Islam.
And, Michael, you were saying that it was kind of an eye-opener for you that here was this mosque right next to a Christian church.
Right. I know before I went, and I'm pretty sure this is the view of many Americans, I thought that different faiths in that area that they were very hostile to each other, and like a person of the Muslim faith would think of someone from a Christian faith that they were wrong, and that like their faith was the right faith and that the Christian faith was the wrong one. And I did not get that sense while I was there. And I know that they may not agree entirely on their ideas, but they more or less agree to disagree. And peace was kept very well between those two religions.
Mary, was that your impression?
I actually studied abroad in Jordan in 2007. So, like, I was a little more familiar with, like, Islam and, like, with the mosque. But I was interested in, like, how well it, like, and how, and for how long it's coexist, like, Islam and Christianity have coexisted. So, I mean, the mosque wasn't so much of a wake-up call as, like, the Orthodoxy and the Maronites, like, all together with Islam.
What about the traditional garb? How many women did you see in burqas with the head coverings and the scarves?
Not very many at all. I was very surprised. Like, I mean, when I started in Jordan, like during it, like 90% of women probably wore it. And in Lebanon, honestly, if I saw like 10 people in one day, I was like, wow, she's wearing a hijab. You know, I would notice it. So,
Jeff, what do you think the students? What impressions do you think they came away from when they saw that mosque?
Well, they were very graciously invited in. Again, like just about everywhere else we went, there was people speaking wonderful, perfectly fluent English. It didn't feel so foreign for them. The interior design was explained to us, the origins of the carpeting, of the lighting, of the stone, and it was from all over the region.
How old was the mosque?
Well, this was a relatively recent mosque. This one was built by Rafik Hariri, who was the prime minister who was assassinated in 2005. So it is, you know, practically speaking, a brand new mosque.
It was built in 2002.
2002, okay.
And that contrasts with other architecture, which goes back hundreds, maybe thousands of years.
Oh, absolutely. Contrasts and then complements it as they incorporate old styles into the new buildings as well.
We're talking to Jeff Lee, Associate Professor of History, UW-Marathon County, and a couple of Wausau East students, Michael Ryer and Mary Baldwin, back from Lebanon. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51. If you'd like to give us a call, here are the numbers, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
Let's turn right now to the Lebanese students. And after all, this is an exchange, so if it's an exchange, there are two parts, right? There are students coming and going, and you got a chance to talk to Jeff, some of the Lebanese students who will be coming over here to get their impressions of Americans and their impressions of Lebanese people who live in America. Before I play this cut, I want to just tell our listeners that it was recorded on a bus in very noisy traffic with cars weaving in and out in downtown Beirut. So listen closely. The audio quality is a little bit iffy at times, but I think you can understand what they have to say.
When you meet Lebanese in the United States, what differences do you notice between yourselves and them?
Like, they're very hardworking. They're different than Lebanese living here.
So you say, Mark, you're not hardworking?
No, we are. We are hardworking, okay. But like, they work much harder than us.
The American students you've met here from Wisconsin, are they a lot like the Lebanese Americans you know?
No.
No?
Most of the Lebanese Americans we know from our school have already lived in Lebanon for a long time. So they've adjusted to live the Lebanese way.
The Lebanese way? What is the Lebanese way?
Party. Just the figure of
party.
Not caring, you know, what happens.
If you ask any American, they've got some preconceived notion of what life in Lebanon is
yeah,
like.
Yeah, they think we're like terrorists. When you say an Arab, you see a guy with a beard and holding like a bomb or like a suicide bomber. That's what they think about us.
Being Lebanese is different than being an Arab.
Okay.
You would feel.
Okay, can you explain that?
I think most Americans, they believe that, you know, most Arabs are Al-Qaeda. But not everybody's like that.
How do you see yourselves as different from the surrounding Arab countries?
They're more
religious.
They're more religious.
For example,
and
the Gulf is run by a Muslim way of living.
Yeah.
And this is like a Christian country. Like
this is more of a diverse.
It's not only a Christian country, it's just a free country.
Everyone.
Okay.
It's all religions combined together.
Okay, and so you think that diversity is better for people?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Much
yeah,
better.
Okay.
Lebanese students who will be coming to America soon, some things that struck me, Jeff Lee, mentioned that their counterparts, Lebanese nationals who live in America, work a lot harder than they do in Lebanon. And you asked them, what is the Lebanese way? And the answer you got was party.
Well, you know, that was their lead-in. They immediately, as you heard with most of the answers, backed off and said, well, it's more complex than that. And they gave a variety of different images. What they see of Americans, Lebanese Americans, a lot have traveled to the United States. And in fact, it seemed that the great majority of Lebanese families had an American citizen somewhere in the extended family. So again, you know, they didn't feel that they were so foreign from us, but they said, you know, in the United States, there's so much competition. position. There's so much pressure to get ahead. There's so much pressure to work hard and to not fall behind that they say it's very hard to enjoy life in the United States.
And maybe with Lebanon being in such a volatile part of the world where, I mean, and it's, what, 3,000-year history?
Sure.
How many different civilizations and invaders have moved in and moved out? Maybe it leads to a different mindset where it's take it one day at a time and enjoy life while you have it.
Well, absolutely. And as was talked about earlier, there's so many fault lines running through the society, so many differences that can be manipulated by politicians that you have a tremendous opportunity for violence. And, of course, as we discussed earlier, democracy kind of brings all that out, brings it to the surface, makes things more difficult and in certain times. And so we have a June elections coming up, and that is expected by the Lebanese to be a very tension-filled time, potentially a dangerous time, something that they're very much worried about.
Let's pick up on that since you gave me the perfect lead-in for it. Here are those same students on that same noisy bus talking about those June elections and about politics in Lebanon.
Are people very aware of politics here?
Yes. We always talk about politics.
A lot of people fight about it.
We have elections coming up in June. Do you think the elections will make people more tense?
Yes, very tense and divided.
So at some times democracy can have this kind of difficult edge to it that erases tensions.
That's also happened all over the world.
How do you think people can get past these divisions? What do they need to do?
Put aside their religion and beliefs, like the political beliefs.
Yeah, and if that doesn't work, then probably like a federal system in the country.
Okay, a system of federalism.
Abolish all these political parties.
No, I thought, like, everyone has their own rules, like in their specific areas, you know?
Okay, so some power be reserved to the central government and other powers to provincial governments or district governments?
Yeah, like Switzerland.
Okay, like Switzerland.
Yeah.
Not as often been called the Switzerland of the Middle East. Do you think that's an accurate description?
Yes, it is accurate.
Yeah. Okay.
Switzerland of the Middle East?
That might be going a little too far, but the interesting analogy there is that Switzerland is also a very diverse country with multiple languages and multiple religions in it. So perhaps Switzerland provides a model, perhaps the United States, which you may know that the Swiss Constitution was established in the 1840s, was based on the U.S. model.
Did either of you talk politics with any of the people you ran into in Lebanon? Not even a little bit?
I did, but mainly about, like, what I talked about, like, Hezbollah and whatnot, more than, like, local politics or whatnot.
Go on, Michael.
I know before we went, politics was one of the warnings I think we received not to talk about.
Not to talk about, like, to the press or anything.
Oh, yeah, right.
But you can talk about it to anyone in the country.
That's basically because politics there is very confusing. And one of the students told me that you have to be born and raised in Lebanon to actually understand Lebanese politics perfectly.
And it wasn't on the clip that we heard, but one of the students on the tape that you brought back said, we stay out of it.
That was one of the answers the students gave, and what I was saying, what I was thinking, and kind of hoping they'd say is, well, look, then let's emphasize what we have in common, and in fact, that goes back to the statements on Hezbollah. A lot of the students were saying, look, you know, even though there's many things I disagree with Hezbollah, they would say they're also a part of us. They're also Lebanese, and that comes first.
Well, we've been told that if we could just go into some of these regions in the Middle East and establish a Jeffersonian-style democracy, an American democracy, all of the problems there would go away. But the reaction you got is, hey, we've got June elections coming up. Things are going to get kind of intense. People are going to be fighting. People are going to be arguing.
You know, that one of the central truisms of world history is that you do have this continuous interplay between different traditions from different parts of the world, and you always have a very difficult time grafting an institution that's derived one place onto a culture in another place. It never settles down easily into that place. And, of course, a democracy has more often failed than succeeded. It's a very difficult system to get working efficiently and durably.
Mary, what's your impression of what you heard on that tape with, you know, with the trepidation for the June elections coming up?
Well, I think it's elections in the past have been so complicated and like often corrupt and often misleading almost. So, I mean, it is complex, and I understand where the fear and like or the anxiety, I guess, is a better word, is coming from. So I don't know. I guess just I'm excited to wait and see what happens.
And they've got kind of a strange system set up, don't they, where certain positions go to some religions and other positions. Mm-hmm. Jeff, could you explain that for us real quickly?
Right. It goes back, you know, the Constitution was initially written in 1926 under the French Mandate authorities. It's a single house legislature, universal male suffrage, universal suffrage now since 1953. And a six-year elected presidency. Now, what you had in 1943 upon independence is the National Pact, which is not written down. It's an oral agreement wherein the presidency would traditionally be a Christian, the prime ministership would be held by a Sunni Muslim, and the Speaker of the Assembly would be held by a Shiite Muslim.
So it's kind of divided up in advance. It's not
you
like...
Bet. You bet, but it's a gentleman's agreement, right? This is not law. This is a long-standing agreement. The Taifa Accords in 1990 said, well, in terms of positions within government, in the cabinet, and in the legislature, we'll divide it 50-50 Christians and Muslims. Now, of course, there are a variety of kinds of Christians, and there are a variety of kind of Muslims in the country.
But by and large, Michael and Mary, Christians and the Muslims get along on a day-to-day basis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And getting back to what some of the Lebanese students said, we know how to enjoy life here. We party, but I think they said the word party in the sense of enjoying life on a day-to-day basis. And one of the other students said, you know, they show up to eat dinner at 9 o'clock in the evening, and they take their time, and they know how to have a good time on in a way that's maybe more relaxed than we do here in America.
Yeah, I know one of those Lebanese students said that their country is a free country, and I think that is very true because during my 1 week stay there, the students, everyone pretty much had so much more freedom, I think, than we do, and that could partly be because of the less maybe competition, as you stated before. But it was a very, like, so much freedom that they had. They would, my host, student, could basically, doing whatever, he wanted to, which is so much more different than, my personal life. And I just found that to be very interesting in such a country that I thought to be so strict beforehand.
And you've got those beautiful beaches, a lot of people on the beaches.
Well, it was like 45 degrees and sleeting while we were there, so not so much.
Well, maybe they were up in the mountains skiing.
Exactly.
Right. You know, and going back to that question of freedom, of course, that's a word that always has changed meaning repeatedly throughout history. And when the Lebanese students said it, they meant it's about their personal life. How secure do they feel? How much do they feel they can go from here to do it there and do various things? And to them, that was freedom. Not so much specific political rights, but that they didn't worry as much.
What they seemed to be upset about was that Americans had the same misconceptions and prejudices that we heard in that first tape from some of these students. They think we're terrorists. They think we all wear turbans. They think, think the worst of us.
And what did they know about central Wisconsin? The Crandon shootings.
Really?
That was what they had heard about.
What they also said on another part of the tape that we didn't listen to, you asked them, what are you looking forward to in America? And they said, we want to go to the malls, the Mall of America. We want to eat at Taco Bell and the International House of Pancakes.
I don't know what our students told them, but that was what they said Wausau would mean to them.
They have their mind made up.
Well, we'll have to get together with the students when they arrive and see if they have misconceptions about Wisconsin and America and maybe about what they consider to be our premier attractions that maybe we can puncture some of their illusions too.
Great.
Jeff Lee, Mary Baldwin, Michael Ryer, thanks so much for being with us. This has been just a delightful and informative hour, and I wish we had more time. You have been listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Next week, we focus again on illiteracy as we welcome Sarah Halstead and Tom Parker of the Portage County Literacy Council. We'll examine how the inability to read or write is hurting our regional economy and adversely affecting even the medical care that's available in north central Wisconsin. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Kelson Quisler. Route 51 can be heard every Thursday at 5 on the Ideas Network stations, WLBL 91.9 FM Wausau, 930 AM Auburndale Stevens Point, WHBM 90.3 FM Park Falls, and WHRM 90.9 FM High Definition Channel 2. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining with us today. Until next week, we are heading out of town.